Please.
Thank you, Bill. So I'm going to be, I think you've all heard a very similar talk in the last few weeks with probably from Richard and from Martha and from Michael. But I'm going to be talking about flu and its evolution and kind of trying to frame things very specifically in how we pick vaccine strains or how the WHO picks vaccine strains. So basically, there will be a strain that's used, say, in the 95, 96 season. And that's actually a strain that was found in 1993 at in Johannesburg. That comes from 94, but it was then used in the 95-96 season, and so on. So there's roughly every other year updates. Sometimes some viruses they use for a little while, some viruses they use for longer, like Moscow 99, but overall we need to keep having updates. And so what I'm going to be talking about is which strains we'd want to pick, and also maybe kind of how we'd want to time the choices. So you've probably seen this sort of background before, where we have a hemagglutinin protein on the surface of the influenza particle. There are about 70% of the proteins, 70% of the peptides in the protein on the surface of the virion are hemagglutinin. So this acts as the primary target for the human immune response, and it's what the virus wants to evolve to also escape human immune response. So it's mainly what people look at. The general pattern we've seen for flu over the last 100 years is these repeated introductions from an animal reservoir that then causes a pandemic. So in 1918, there was a bird-to-human transition from H1N1. This one is just the first hemagglutinin that we saw, and N is the first neuraminidase protein, which is another surface protein that we saw. And please interrupt me if you have any questions. And it moves into humans, causes a massive pandemic, kills 50 million people, but then is able to continue to persist in the human population by evolving year to year and season to season. But then in 1957, there's a second bird-to-human transition that causes a smaller pandemic. It actually displaces old H1N1. It lasts until there's a reassortment event that moves a new H3, a new hemagglutinin protein, onto the H2N2 background that kills off H2N2. H3N2 persists. 1977, there's what's thought to be a Soviet lab accident, and H1N1 is released back into the wild after sitting in the freezer for 20 years. Because there's still some human immunity, it doesn't cause much of a pandemic, and it's able to kind of coexist alongside H3N2. And then in 2009, we had the swine origin H1N1, which is a very different H1N1. It kills off old H1N1. And so today we have, of influenza A, we have H3N2 and H1N1 circulating. And swine H1N1.
Is that the P in front of H?
The P, this is, no, pandemic, which is kind of the wrong word because all of these used to be pandemic, but that seems to be what people, I think it's now just, you can just say H1N1, it's been enough years. If we look at, this is just HA sequences I grabbed from GenBank, looked at just the amino acids of them, and it's like a histogram, basically, where each color is a unique amino acid sequence. And basically what you can see that over the last, just in the course of 10 years, there's massive turnover of the population. And there might be one major variant at any given time and a bunch of minor variants, but that quickly will disappear and be superseded. And so if we look over the course of 10 years, we get about 1 in 20 sites will differ. This actually works out that theta is almost exactly what it is for Drosophila. So, and the time scales are such that if this was a scale of 1 million years and you did these samples, you get a very similar picture for kind of random Drosophila gene. So there's not very much standing genetic variation, but lots of turnover. This picture is the same as this picture, just coded differently. Oh, yeah.
How does that variation seem in here differ from the variation that would coincide with a completely new pandemic? You know, what's the...
I see. Is there a board? Yeah. So it's this picture here. So this is kind of this turn. Oh, thank you. This ladder-like tree just means that if we slice it at any point in time, there's not very much diversity, basically. But there's a lot of divergence because you still can kind of go forward. But in a new pandemic, if there isn't antigenic evolution, if there isn't turnover in the population, you'll expect to see something that's much more comb-like going forward. And so in this case, there would be kind of growing diversity until you hit some point, and then it will saturate. Is kind of what you expect with new emergence. So
different strains are easily 10-20%. So if you compare H1 and H3.
H1 and H3 are quite far apart. 1,000 years, maybe, something of that order, maybe more.
Yeah, so everything that is free to change has changed.
Whereas the colors on the previous plot distinguish alleles that differ by one or two residues.
So this picture here, where you're seeing kind of very fast replacement, is the same as this picture here, very roughly. We go from 2000 to 2012 in H3 and 2, that if we look at the population and slice it, there's very little diversity. But you can see that if what this is also indicative of is that, let's say we take a virus here in 2005, there's a single person that's sick with flu in 2005, that in just 3 years, go to 2008, every person in the world that's sick with flu, all tens of millions of people, will descend from that single sneeze. So it's this kind of very strong selection on this new variant taking over and replacing what's there. Yeah?
Do new variants just arise in one person?
Well, originally, like that mutation had to occur somewhere, and it occurs in the person, so there's some. So you could have a variant here and a variant here and a variant here, but then there will be an actual amino acid transition that's occurred within a single individual, and that will eventually fix in the population. Each branch is, you could like put humans along all of these branches. You could make them a chain of infection if you had that information. So there.
Well, that's actually an interesting question. Yeah. What extent are we certain that this is the case, right? Since every mutation happens in every human every day.
Okay. Wait, so what's the alternative?
So I don't understand. It's based on amino acids, but maybe sort of the transmission history is actually quite different, and many of these things happen in parallel all the time, in the sense that it's a soft pathogen.
Well, in some sense, it's not, right? It's
The same mutation could appear here.
In different individuals, but if other mutation happens, so it's different tickets of mutation, right? Different combinations. Otherwise, you would have soft sweeps, as we are here today.
Yeah, but we don't see sort of many homophases on these traits, right? Mm-hmm. So that is certainly not a limiting factor. The question really is, well, as these sort of trunk lineages you have, are they one individual? So in the recent past, they are probably multiple individuals, right? So a particular nuclei might have happened several times.
I'm thinking of this as the actual genealogy of the virus, the infection tree. And you can kind of put tick marks on here where there are transitions, where there have been an amino acid change. And that same amino acid change could happen on multiple backgrounds and multiple times. And so,
but say you took this sort of before trunk variant,
okay,
which is sort of a nice one to point out, right? This implies that there was a certain 2-3 mutations that happened in along one chain. Mm-hmm. But if that sort of happened on multiple chains, mm-hmm. this little branch would actually be a little thicker, right? Mm-hmm. Would have multiple parallel bonds, which after a while would. Or you still go back to one, but I don't think we actually know how much parallel conversion evolution happens on the track.
Do you think that once you reach a certain point in time, mm-hmm. that only certain mutations are going to be effectively fixed? I mean, that's to say, is it possible that you get recurrent mutation, which is almost indistinguishable from single mutation, because those recurrent mutations always occur fundamentally on the same backbone. So unless you actually know the explicit transmission events, you couldn't distinguish them. If you simply meet five people in the same room, all got the same mutation, because they're all carrying the same strain.
I guess once we go back, mm-hmm. a few more of these questions, and probably we'll go back to single image, pretty sure. I think it's not an academic question.
To ask your question specifically.
I think a single disease was sort of more of a figure of speech.
So, for example, in 2004, the single H1 viruses split into three separate lineages. They each diverged, but then within about 6 months of each other, they each acquired the same amino acid substitution that caused the same antigenic change. Sure, if the virus weren't constrained, it could have gone off and done other things in those different backgrounds.
So that constrains every one of the gene has constraints.
But then,
at least in H1, there definitely was. For H3, we don't know.
One of those eventually won, so.
Yes, for the 2 years.
Yes.
I guess. The relevant point is that there's no ancestral variation that is kept for more than 3 years, as you pointed out. So there can be such event, but there must be small scale.
Yeah. I'm picturing this just as this. There's sweeps on top of sweeps on top of sweeps, and so there's a lot of overlapping adaptive evolution. So this is. You've probably heard more about this, maybe less about this, but probably some about this. So I've been working on antigenic cartography along with other people and how these assays work. And so this is where we have genetic information, we have these sequences, but we actually want to know how the viruses are seeing each other in kind of an ecological sense and what how they're really, the pressures they're under to evolve. So the standard assay here is the hemagglutination inhibition assay. In a hemagglutination assay, if you take a red blood cell and you put it in a well, it will, red blood cells, it will sink to the bottom and form this dot. If you combine virus with the red blood cells, the virus binds to the red blood cells, you get a lattice. So you can see, by comparing this to this, you can see whether there's virus present or absent. Then in the hemagglutination inhibition assay, if you combine red blood cells with virus with antibodies, if the antibodies can effectively bind to the virus is no longer able to bind to red blood cells, and you go back to the dot. And so how this then works by kind of the WHO collaborating centers is that they will take a ferret, infect it with, say, virus A, then draw blood a couple weeks later, centrifuge out the antibodies, and then dilution series, where this is 1 in 40 concentration, 1 in 80 concentration, 1 in 160, and they see that then if you take antibodies derived from A, use it against virus A, you can go up to a titer of a very low concentration of 1280, 1 to 1280, and you'll still get inhibition, whereas if we go to 2560, we lose inhibition. So this is saying that we can have a very minute amount of antibody and it'll still work. We can see then if we take the same antibodies against virus A and can react them against virus B, we can see that they also react strongly. So that we also get a titer of 1280. This would indicate roughly that infection with virus A will protect you against virus A and will protect you against virus B. We see that C and D have titers that are dropped by 1 2-fold unit, so we get mostly cross-immune, whereas viruses E, F, and G have a low dilution here, have a low titer, suggesting then that infection by A wouldn't protect you against E, F, and G. So how these end up looking at the strain selection type meetings is that there'll be a set of reference sera and reference viruses. These are matched. You can see Wisconsin 67 here, Wisconsin 67 here. This is ferret 1 from 2006. And then this is now the titer of 1280 against the homologous comparison. We also get a high titer of Wisconsin against Brisbane, suggesting they react strongly. But then if we compare sera raised against Wisconsin, it doesn't react as well as against Uruguay, Hong Kong, Perth, et cetera. So this is, you can kind of see antigenic evolution happening here. You can see then, just from looking at the table, that there's more or less a block of viruses that react strongly, these guys, and a block of viruses that react strongly over here, these guys. And then because this is much more expensive to make, what you can do is you can take these reference panel of sera and react it against hex viruses. And so then it usually will have a number of viruses here that aren't present as sera. Yeah?
So what are the error bars here? How reproducible is it from ferret to ferret?
So assay to assay is very reproducible. Ferret to ferret has a fair amount of variation, especially in the strength of this. And so this is probably the biggest thing, where if you took another ferret and infected with Wisconsin 6705, the homologous titer might be 2560, it might be 640. Some ferrets react strongly, and some react less strongly. And this is something that we will take care of in just a moment.
So you just divide through by the diagonal.
Basically. Okay. So, however, you can kind of look at this and make sense of this. But the data that we really have now is something much more like this, where, and even worse for the actual people that have all the data, of 27,000 measurements, and you want to kind of somehow make sense of that. And by eye, I challenge you. So what Derek Smith and colleagues...
Can we go back and just get a little bit oriented to what we're seeing here?
Okay, so the standard, this is kind of a blow up of this.
Yeah, so there are dots for...
So all of the, a dot is, we have a measurement, and the gray is we don't have a measurement. So it's very sparse. So out of the, this is about 400 by 400, so we could have 160,000 measurements. We have 27,000 measurements.
And the calls in this are made automatically by a machine or no? It is all done by eye.
So then in each dot you find a number.
Yes. Yes. In some cases, the little alpha complication is that some dots say it's less than 40.
Yeah.
So it's below the
limit of detection.
Yeah. Okay. So Derek Smith and colleagues developed this antigen cryptography method, which is basically multidimensional scaling. And the idea is that if we have a number of these pairwise comparisons, say of purple to orange and purple to blue, we can kind of reorient things and then be able to just lay things out on some surface. And then those two pairwise comparisons are just recapitulated by the distance between points on the map.
But this isn't really a strategy that's driven in the first instance by the sparseness of the data. You know, if the matrix were fully populated,
yes,
we'd still be very happy to have this,
yes,
drop in dimensionality.
Absolutely.
But then you would just do principal component. Mm-hmm. Then you wouldn't need...
Well, you could do principal components in the same way with an objective function, the way that MDS is done here. And some folks have used PCA rather than MDS. It's not as MDS is nice in that you can just kind of find clusters and you can see like this is similar to this, whereas PCA you end up looking at angles that things have and it's maybe less interpretable.
So this is present in sort of two axes here.
Mm.
Presumably there are subsequent axes that it could be presented on,
yes,
as well. How much do you miss by just looking at the first two axes?
Can I delay that three slides?
Yes.
Okay. So the schematic here is that basically, let's say we have three viruses, A, B, and C, and we have sera raised against A and B. These are titers that we've observed of 2560 from A against A, 320 from A against B. How the map works is we also need to know the potency. This is the thing that we don't actually have a direct measurement of. This is if there's a perfectly matched virus, perfectly matched antigen to a serum, how potent would it be? What's its maximum possible titer? And so we are going to say that's 5120, and we're going to say this is 2560. So in this case, if we have a one unit distance from a serum to a virus, we'll drop this by one twofold dilution from 5120 to 2560. If we have a threefold distance from red serum to yellow virus, will go down to 640, and so that's a threefold from 5120. And so that's all of how this cryptography stuff works. The way that Derek had been doing things was this kind of objective function heuristic, minimizing the sum of squared errors, and that's nice and fast and works well. What Andrew Rambeau and Mark Suchard and I had been up to was trying to do things in a more likelihood with a probabilistic framework, so you could build in other things if we so desire. So it's now we'll call Bayesian multidimensional scaling. And in this case, you end up with some probability of observing a particular titer, which is this, again, the serum potency, subtract out the distance between the virus and the serum, and that gives you some probabilistic idea of how likely a certain titer is to observe, and then you can just get the likelihood of all your titers by taking the product of these things. So then in the Bayesian context, you can just run MCMC and then find the virus and serum locations. And so, okay, slide for Ian. The first thing that I wanted to look at here was just how many dimensions do you need? So the way that I was doing this was by making a training data set with 6,500 measurements, a test data set with 700 measurements, making map locations from the training data set and then trying to predict titers of the test data set. And so if we try to predict titers with one dimension, we get a test error of around one log two unit, one two-fold dilution on average. If we use two dimensions, we get a test error of 0.86. But if we use three, we actually increase our test error. And this is because of standard kind of overfitting issues that you get in machine learning sort of things all the time. And so there are too many parameters here, and there's a good amount of parameters for the data here. Okay, so we're gonna use two dimensions. And when we do this with the Bayesian sort of MDS, we go from 68 to 2011, we see something that looks a lot like the 2004 paper, where we get kind of some clusters, but more or less we get continual movement. The blue circles are viruses, the gray dots are sera. You can see that this is made up by local measurements. So for the most part, anything more than 10 years apart will have a titer less than 40, and you can't actually detect it. So to some degree, this could have some curvature, and it's hard to, the likelihood of this is not very much different than the likelihood of something like this. We know it can't kind of wrap around completely, but because of the way the measurements are done, the local structure is very clear, and the local structure like this to this, and this to this, and this to this is really clear, but exactly the distance from this virus to this virus is a little more uncertain, yeah?
So the virus has never gone back to a previous antigenic type.
We've never
gone back to that space. None of those are cross-reacted from what we've seen so far.
Yes, and keep in mind that there are still people around today that had H3 infections, 1968-like infections as children. So there's pressure in the human population for those things not to be spreading. I guess it's weird that they haven't kind of appeared as blips. I do think that says something about the overall size of this antigenic space, that it must be large. Otherwise, we would have been seeing returns kind of cropping up of previous antigenic types. Yeah.
So I guess I didn't quite understand the previous slide and this test analysis, which led you to two and interesting dimension.
So
what was the training data set?
So the training data set. So I just took my titers, my HI titers, and I took 90% of them and called them at random, called them training, and 10% and called it test.
Okay.
And then tried to predict titers and titers.
And they were, on average, 0.86 units away from where they actually should be.
Yes, more than that, because it's not just where they should be, it's you have this potency and so on, so it's right. Actually, I'm trying to predict what is the titer of this serum versus this virus. And so then I do everything in log 2 scale, and so then this is in log 2 units, the difference of titer. Okay, and so if we look over time, we see that there's been this continual evolution of H3N2 and lots of drift, and kind of looking like that ladder-like phylogeny, where if we slice it in any given moment, there's not a lot of variation, but there's a lot of divergence through time. Okay, so that's more or less background. For the vaccine strain selection problem, how it basically works is there are national influenza centers all over the world, and they feed viruses up the chain to collaborating centers in Atlanta, London, Beijing, Tokyo, and Melbourne. The collaborating centers do the genetic characterization and the antigenic characterization. So there will be a strain selection meeting in February of 2015. There are viruses that will be isolated up to the end of the season through around January. It takes a little bit of time for those to be characterized, and then there'll be strain selection. and then selection of by-birth sortants, manufacture, licensure, packaging, distribution, to finally get to vaccination in October. So basically, what we're looking at is roughly a year in advance thing, where we want to find a virus that's circulating, say, in fall of 2014, to be able to use in a vaccine in fall of 2015.
So the pharmacy I walk by every morning,
yeah,
advertise flu shots now.
Yes.
That's last year's?
That's last year's. you're welcome to get it.
I'm sorry, what's the high growth rate sortants?
Sorry, yeah. So what, it's a strange thing where they're only selecting for H and N from circulating viruses, and they want something, a virus, to make the vaccine that grows really quickly. So they reassort the H and the N that they pick into a backbone, a background of, I think it's, Colin, help me out here, it's like from 1930s. Okay. And that grow really well. And so they need to do that to, I guess, kind of hit this date here with the manufacturer.
Yeah, so one of the key limitations of infection vaccines is the rate at which the viruses grow. And by and large, the viruses that you pick, in terms of the ones you want to put into the vaccine, they don't grow well enough to actually develop or pack the quantity of vaccine that you want to have around the vaccination time. So there should be a sort of virus that you know grows extremely well.
So,
and it's like, well,
so because of that, if there are any epitopes, like CTL epitopes in internal proteins, you won't get any of that. Even in the light attenuated virus, they've done this, so you're not getting kind of the proper, the proper T cell response. Strange. Sorry, go ahead.
Since I missed it, I believe you didn't, but the dominant thing that's coming out of everything you're saying is that at any one point in time, there's a very limited number of strains circulating.
You still have to pick one. It's maybe limited number compared to HIV. There's not a lot. So pi is 1% of all the flu that's in the world today. So it's the same scale as if you have a particular Drosophila gene and you wanted to pick a variant. You look at all the Drosophila all over the world, and that does seem diverse, I guess.
Given the amount of diversity that's been seen in the last century, for example, we're seeing only a tiny fraction of that diversity in the extant population. So is there a very simple explanation as to why we don't see, you know, five different variants circulating right now? If we just took the diversity you've seen in the last century and just randomly picked, things 20 years apart. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have those five strains circulating now? Is that potentially because there's some sort of non-specific immunity, so when anything sweeps through it, sort of neutralizes the rest, or what?
That's definitely, so that I think the question is coming back to what a lot of kind of the modeling community around this has spent a lot of effort on. Is why does the tree look like this,
yes,
rather than you could imagine it bifurcating?
Or indeed allowing multiple introductions.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it could go back a long way. But.
And it's not that it's completely impossible. I mean, the influence of B is solved at some point in the past.
But the influence of B could have been allopatric speciation.
Yeah.
So there you could basically, what you need is that antigenic variants are emerging, and what you need some sort of interference between those variants, so that the strength of interference is such that always all but one of them get killed off.
I mean, the thing that's surprising here is it appears to be behaving like a global village. Why is that? Is that because in terms of the transmission dynamics here, A, we're a global village, and B, strain A, neutralizes?
Well, that's pretty much what it is. Yeah. So there's a global sourcing dynamic for H strain two, where new variants come out of East and Southeast Asia every year, spread worldwide, and then
Cambodia.
But then they go locally extinct after epidemics are over. So when you get a virus in North America, you're going to have that epidemic, and then as soon as that epidemic is over, those strains go extinct.
But
that's the end of those viruses.
I don't know how much shorter the side branches are, or how much, if it was any less ladder-like in 1970.
That's the real question.
Whoever gets there first.
When people have looked in kind of much more isolated communities which have less access to other people, is to see whether this same dynamic holds in more kind of communities which have much less migration of these strains.
That's a good question. I mean, so what Colin was just talking about. Yeah. So if you kind of take the global airline network and do this with seasonality, you get South America as this thing at the end of the spectrum where the kind of flu gets there and then it dies. And I don't know how this works in isolated islands in, say, the South Pacific.
I mean, that's kind of the situation.
It's definitely not, you're not going to get kind of, some of these viruses are these far-flung locations. So you're not going to find things that are really kind of outside of this pattern, but are not, I suspect they're going to be these kind of ones near the ends of the side branches, rather than the source population along the trunk.
Okay.
So I'm just repeating something, but I think you said the following, let me just play back to you, that maybe to extinguish an epidemic, that's to say a situation where people get very, very ill, you may need a highly specific antibody response.
Yes.
Whereas to extinguish, you can provide a lower level of immunity against every strain. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, that scenario is enough to account for why you always had a dominant strain.
That's a hypothesis. one of them is that there's enough T cell pressure that will be strain transcending. That will, if you get sick with this virus, you'll be protected against everything else to a strong enough degree and for a limited amount of time that the overall dynamics will end up looking like this. But there are other explanations as well to some degree. Yeah.
I just wanted to loop back to the process of strain selection. So these things are isolated and characterized. Is that anything more than a whole bunch of human inhibition assays? What does the
characterization mean?
What are the data that go into making the decision?
So I'm pretty sure it's not anything besides HI and genetics, and so there'll be some choice in antiviral resistance. There's HI done on humans, on panels of human sera as well to look for escape variants. But there's neutralization assays done to confirm the HI, but the primary thing is HI. Just behind that, secondary is genetics, and these other things are supporting evidence. Colin, yeah?
Yeah,
no, okay.
Absolutely.
And so the actual choice, I don't know enough to really say what clinches it in any particular year of what virus to use. There are additional considerations of you want a virus that's already been distributed among centers so that everyone can kind of immediately start growing it up. Kind of logistical considerations. But let's kind of get at what Dan's asking, and let's imagine it's now February 2006. We have viruses from 2005, and we're going to want to pick the strain that we're going to use in October 2006. And so this is not actually what the WHO was looking at, but it's as close to what they were looking at as I can make it. Where we have all of this is data where it's HI assays that have been done through the end of 2005. And so and then the colored dots are showing previous vaccine strains. At this meeting now, we have kind of all of these possible viruses. There's California 7, 2004 is the current vaccine strain. And we need to decide whether we want to update. And so just from this, it kind of looks like, well, the virus has been moving along, and we want something that's kind of over here, that there's been some movement of the virus in this antigenic space. The WHO calls for a fourfold difference in HI, or 2 units on this map, is sufficient to warrant an update. And what they chose is Wisconsin 67, 2005, which is kind of makes sense if you're looking at this picture. But then why Wisconsin 67 rather than this guy or this guy or this guy? There's a lot of nearby viruses that we could have chosen. If we If we look at then go forward a year and look at the season of from 2006 to 2007, so viruses, now these dark dots are viruses between October 2006 and March 2007. And so this is where the population actually went. It kind of is over here. And the red square is their centroid. And so I would contend that the optimal choice would have been the center of this population. And that will kind of cover as much ground as possible.
Okay. Could the choice of that vaccine and the distribution of that vaccine to people not have driven things further away?
This is an open question. Generally, it had been assumed that coverage was low enough and the vaccine is not as effective as natural immunity, that it's not going, that most of the evolution of the viruses is not due to vaccine pressure. Maybe a bit of supporting evidence there is that slope that we saw before here, this has been remarkably constant since 68 to present, and the vaccine, we've changed our vaccination here. So that suggests that. There's also an issue of this global source sink dynamics where they're not vaccinating in China so much at all. And so,
yeah.
So whatever, even if we, so unclear if the vaccine's having any effect on the evolution here. Even if it is having an effect, vaccination that we're doing in these temperate regions, US, Europe, et cetera, should not feedback and cause and affect the subsequent evolution of the virus. So we want to be as close as possible to red square. We can then rank viruses and see that Wisconsin 67 is actually quite a good choice. It's quite close to this red square. And so what I'm now going to do is talk about kind of the algorithm I came up to pick. And just out of curiosity, how many people are familiar with Kalman filters here? Physicists, yes. They developed originally with Apollo missions, used later for ballistic missiles, and now most familiar with your phone and GPS. So this is downtown Seattle. If we don't have a Kalman filter, we have the phone just pinging, and it's just getting a GPS ping every however many seconds. And so it says it's here, it's in this moving car, then it's here, here. And you wouldn't want the blue dot on your phone kind of bouncing around like that. So instead, what you do is you have a dynamical model of where the phone is, how fast it's going, what's its acceleration, and how certainty you have again about all those vectors. And as GPS pings come in, you update that dynamical system. And so then it gives a kind of continuous version of where the phone is through time. And it's a really simple algorithm. It's really great. It's all normal distributions and just a single pass. You make a predict step of, with the gray circle is meant to be uncertainty about where the phone is. This is where the phone thinks it's going, where the system thinks it's going. We project forward. We can see that our uncertainty increases. And then we have a ping from GPS, and that shrinks it. And then and corrects. And we project forward, and then we correct. And if we keep doing that, we'll get a inference of the chain of states that the phone was through time and these vectors. So we're just gonna do this exact model. It's location and velocity, and that's now the flu population, the exact model. So we have in 1990, these gray dots are flu samples that were their antigenic locations. The black point is the center of that population. The gray circle is how uncertain we are about it. And as we go forward, as new dots come in, we're going to kind of be tracing where flu is going. And you can see that when there's not a lot of virus, it's a lot of uncertainty. But once we get a lot of virus in 2002, we're quite certain. And we can see then that there are kind of some jumps and some stutters. Like if we look here, that there's a jump from around this point where we go, sorry, it sticks around here in 2009 and then kind of has this faster transition over here and then kind of some maybe more slow over here, so on. What we can also do then is just add on a look 1 year look ahead, that from the current velocity vector where do we think the virus will be in 1 year's time? And so you can see how good this is basically how closely the black and red lines match up. And we get something that looks pretty good. If we kind of, this is maybe more sensical, more easy to understand, we look at time versus dimension one, we see that there's a pretty nice overlap. For the most part, there's part of the reason this was easy here is that there is this very kind of nice continual movement of the virus from these years, and then not a lot of change in dimension two. So now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to look year to year and take this step ahead prediction of where the center of the population will be, and I'm going to rank viruses by how close they are to that.
How many steps in the past influence your prediction for the next step?
So that's a good question. I couldn't tell you exactly the amount of memory here.
What dimension one is, yes, is only clear afterwards, right? Because you so how this projection on the dimensions work?
That's a good question. So here, you know, here it's cheating a little bit in this picture, in that I have data all the way to 2011. And so this is showing the overlap of that dimension one has been set in this. So that dimension one in 2000 has been set in this picture. However, in what I'm going to show you, I've stopped the Kalman filter so in 2005, when we're making the call in February 2006, I only use the map up to 2000, the end of 2005, in the same picture as we have here. The same picture, this exact picture here. And so the filter has done something like this, and it's somewhere over here, and it's saying it's going somewhere this way. And it's exactly what we have here. And so you can imagine if the map is getting kind of, if that dimension one is getting fixed by these kind of future measurements, that would be kind of pulling a virus over here in 2005. Then when we get future measurements in 2006 and so on, that gets reoriented to be along dimension one. And so I could imagine that being an issue, but I'm trying not to cheat. I'm using only the data up to the end of each season.
And generalizing that point of Michael's means that in the original, for example, in the original picture in the science paper, the dimensions were fixed by the total diversity,
yep,
the total evolution over, yep, the entire data set, not at each time point given the diversity,
yes,
of those.
Yes. So the dimension one is maximizing the first component variance
over the entire time. So if you did the same analysis only with a few, you know, you can imagine doing analysis in a sliding window,
yeah,
and the dimensions then are moving.
Yeah, you could.
Has that been tried?
Not to my knowledge.
But just essentially, yeah, what you're doing.
It's what you're doing.
Yes, I could make that plot.
And that's not what you did here, because when you added the next year's points, you put them in the same coordinates.
Here, this picture is cheating a bit. It's not the actual analysis. I'm not cheating. This picture is cheating.
Yeah.
In that, I concluded the 2006 to 2007 viruses here and just didn't show them
right
there. But the actual analysis, I didn't have the 2006 and 2007 viruses. But yeah, so I will have my predicted mean. I'm just gonna skip ahead a little bit. Okay, maybe it's just easiest to show this.
Yeah.
Okay, so I do have my predicted distance to center and the posterior distance to center. From this is up to the through 2002. I could instead just have location or something like this and see how much the location changes as we get more data. That would be very possible.
It wasn't crystal clear to me. What's your transition model when you go your predict step? And how you have parameterized that. Let's say it's a Gaussian,
yes,
you need to learn the variance state.
Yes.
And is that variance now a global parameter across the whole data set?
There's two parameters. There's dynamical error of the how much variance there is kind of in moving forward.
Yeah.
And there's how much variance there is in picking a location and So yeah, so there's essentially, if this is the center, how much measurement noise is there in grabbing each of these?
Yeah.
And I, that is easy to estimate given kind of a known center and where these are. I can just maximize that. And for the model, the dynamical error, or what that Gaussian error, I train it on 1 year look ahead.
So it's not the global. So this is kind of
yeah. No, it's a global. So there are two yeah. fixed parameters.
And that's the persistence of the orb, of your trajectory.
Yes.
And what's the number?
One. Is that the actual fixed one?
Is that somehow should translate
yeah.
to how far forward you can try to make something?
Oh, I see. That's a good point. So
if there's no persistence, then you can't predict the next year. Since
yeah, it's just kind of will wildly vary.
Yeah.
So I fit that based upon the easiest picture is this to see it of trying to minimize this. If we look ahead a year, trying to pick where the gray dots are.
Yeah.
So there the common filter thing. This wasn't super fancy and wasn't a lot of tuning. I could imagine a better common filter than what I have here. So
what's the biological basis
yeah.
of this persistence? I mean, is there any mechanism that would suggest that?
Well, so you can imagine kind of Fisher's fundamental theorem. So you can imagine that there's variation in the population, and so it's going to be kind of evolving along some axis where there's variation, and then you can also imagine that there's human immunity in kind of some vector, or some contour, and so it seems like this is somewhat sensical that you'd kind of be picking a line of greatest descent or greatest ascent in this fitness landscape and following it for a time, and then the mutations would appear and then you kind of end up following them. But if you have standing genetic variation of some cloud of points, you're going to kind of follow that line. Is that fair?
So it's some kind of readout of the human immune system.
Yeah.
But that's what's really behind this thing.
Yes.
And to be more explicit, is it some sort of readout of some sort of immunoglobulin structure? I mean, is that what it translates to?
Yeah.
Explicitly, or?
Yeah.
To do with.
Sorry, I want to get that picture for. Yeah.
I would also have to do with sort of the age structure of infection, right? So when, what part of the human population was infected, how many years ago, this antigenic was in the strain?
Yes. So this is the picture that I was kind of trying to draw, where this is simulated data, and we have these different viruses that are in the population at a given time, and you can actually draw contours in the simulated data of what the actual immunity contours look like. But if you have a virus over here, only 50% of the time would actually be able to infect someone because there's a lot of immunity to it, whereas over here there's less. And so when you have this kind of human immunity that the virus is evolving away from, then you're going to want to go on this sort of trajectory.
Hmm. Why aren't the jumps bigger?
On this here, yes, that's a good question. So in the simulated data, these are the kind of what I have, a discrete number of actual virus antigenic phenotypes. And so there's a bunch of viruses with this particular phenotype and only a couple viruses or one or two viruses with this this phenotype. Whereas in the antigenic map, the cryptography, each virus gets its unique parameter. So even though this is a good picture of it. So in the kind of classical map here, you'd expect that there might actually only be one phenotype here that all these viruses share. They're still slightly jittered from one another just due to kind of estimation noise. And so I am, at the moment, working on trying to make a model that basically collapses, a Bayesian process kind of model that collapses things.
And I guess what I really mean is why is the distance between HK68 to EN72, why is it just that far and it doesn't jump to a much more distant antigenic type?
I would say that's as big as that mutation was. Or I mean, this is really nice.
But why do mutations never occur that are bigger? Okay.
It's a very fuzzy question, forgive me. But if you now try to sort of map structure on function for, say, the evolution of an effective antibody response, pose this in a very fuzzy way, but what would that look like? I mean, would you find that, you know, discrete changes in the human globulin structure mapped in a rather continuous way onto ability to inhibit the virus? Or would there be massive sort of quantum jumps that, you know, a particular molecular change in the human globulin, you know, a minor change, had a sort of massive difference in its strain specificity? Do you see what I'm trying to get at? What I'm trying to understand is whether there's something that's fairly continuous in the process of the evolution of our antibody response that then constrains viral evolution in a rather continuous and predictable way.
Yeah, it's you can picture that in the map, like over here maybe, that this point is a serum response and it's targeted at a particular virus. And there would be a particular virus that would maximize that, and as we get farther away, it drops lower. That serum response could be one antibody that targets that point really well, or it could be a spectrum of antibodies that kind of target those epitopes in that virus differently. It's probably some polyclonal response. And so the gray dot, the viruses are kind of actual discrete things, where the gray serum responses are actually this agglomerate of all of these different antibody responses.
I'll phrase it slightly differently. I'm not sure I'm getting it right, but if you took the antibody responses of people 3 years ago, are they going to be much better against this year strain of virus than the antibodies of people 30 years ago?
Yes. Okay. So results. If we look at 2002, we do predicted distance to center, posterior distance to center. The WHO choice is the colored dot, and my choice is I don't pick the one that's farthest this way always on the predicted distance center. What I'm doing is I'm looking, because it's this Bayesian thing, I have credible intervals, and there are some viruses that have much wider credible intervals than others. And that's basically viruses that don't have very many HI assays, where there are viruses that have a lot of HI, have more HI assays and are more tuned on where they are. So I pick the virus that has 95% upper confidence interval is as low as possible. So it's a virus that we're confident that is close to the center of where the Kalman filter thinks the virus population will be. So in this case, it was Guam 228-2002. And then when we go forward a year, we see that Guam 228-2002 was a good choice. It's far down the page. There's only a few viruses that would have been a better choice than it. And critically, it's much improved over the WHO choice here. They should have updated in 2002. And so my metrics that I was just looking at was, if I look at all the strains that are circulating that I have from 2002, the choice that I pick is 90%. The choice that I make is better than 90% of them, and it's at 4.72 HI units over the WHO choice. If we go forward a year to 2003, the WHO then chooses to update. They update the Fujian 411 from 2002, and that's here. And we can see then that that there's not a lot of room for improvement above that in kind of my predictions, but I predict to go this virus instead. Brisbane 7, and that ends up being about one unit better than the WHO choice, better than 83% of strains from 2003. If we go forward, and the WHO again chooses to update to California 7, 2004, here, so from here to here, and I choose this virus, Christchurch 2004. In this case, it's a little disappointing in that I predict this is going to be much better than WHO, but it's only a little bit better, so it's not, that's maybe not quite working as well.
Trevor, can you explain how you're locating the gray dots? Those are strains.
Sorry, so the gray, each gray dot is a, on this axis, it's the distance, the Euclidean distance, to the center of the population in 1 year's time. And so this is a look ahead. If I look ahead 1 year and I predict where, so.
You predict where the center's gonna be and then you compute the distance.
Of that virus to the center.
And then the y-axis.
I do that across my 1,000 MCMC outputs and I'm showing now the median across the 1,000. The y-axis is I now include the data from a year ahead, and I then use the data from a year ahead to get a center of the population, and I compute how close is this virus to that center. So if the Kalman filter and if everything was working perfectly, this would be a perfect line.
With what slope?
One. Yeah. Yes. And so yeah. So these are good estimates. These are viruses that in this case, these were things that I predicted were close, but they're actually, they ended up not being close at all.
So the gray dots cover what time period?
The gray dots cover everything. So in this case, from 2004, this is 2004 all the way back to 1990, and it kind of comes off the page at that point.
And just out of curiosity, do you have a sense of where the most recent year strains fall on this plot?
Well, so the selection panel had all of, because sometimes, like in this year, they have viruses from 2003, but they picked a 2002 virus. So they don't always, they usually pick the previous years, but sometimes.
How well would just picking the latest strain do?
That's okay.
Yeah, I did that for a different analysis before.
February that season.
You mean, so in February 2004, just pick a random virus from 2003. Is that what you mean?
Well, in February 2004, pick a virus from February 2004 to pick the latest isolates.
Well, but there's, you pick the isolate from December 31st, 2003. Which one do you actually pick?
Yeah, so you have a good cutoff of isolates that are in your panel, right?
Yes.
So how well will just take the most recent one do?
Okay, so that, I mean, that's going to be the late, in this case, something from late December.
Late December, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so we get an improvement here.
Obsolete the whole process.
I don't think it does terribly well.
In 2005, we both picked Wisconsin 05, which is nice, which is interesting to see. And you can see that this is a good choice. There's not much better than it. There's not much better than it that we could have chosen. Sorry, down here.
Yeah.
It's better than 91% of strains from 2005. In 2006, this is again the WHO should have updated in 2006, according to me, where there's all of these possibilities. Sorry, these possibilities that we think are advanced, and they chose not to update. And then the choice of this Korean strain would be significantly improved by about 2.5 units. We go for it again. They chose to update to Brisbane 2007 here. The choice of Lyon is slightly improved. And then the choice of Toulon is slightly improved. Perth, Cameroon from 2009 is improved over Perth 2009, and Turkey 2009 is improved over Perth 2009 again. So we get, what we get is that there's improvement in 8 of 9 cases with this algorithm equal to 1. We get 2 mismatches, which are important to avoid in 2002-2006. Average improvement of 1.7 HI units. This is now maybe over the top, but I'm trying not to be. That 1 unit of HI mismatch is maybe 5%, 10% improvement in vaccine efficacy. So we could maybe get 10% improvement of efficacy if we used these numbers rather than WHO numbers, and that because coverage is so high, we get thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that don't get flu, which is just like impressive for any of this prediction stuff. That this calculation surprised me because coverage is so high that just a very small improvement in efficacy translates into a lot of people that don't get sick. From this, we also can maybe have a better idea of when we should update and when we shouldn't. So here is my posterior distance to center year by year as these X's. And so we could choose years where we think that we need to update and where we don't think we need to update based upon how much of an improvement we'd be getting from the algorithm. And so, yeah, because there's a cost involved in actually updating.
But these are posterior distances. You don't know them when you make the decision.
Sorry, yeah. So I should have the predicted distance in this picture. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And so thinking about moving forward, there's an issue in that if I want to do this and kind of post something for what's going on in 2014-2015 or come February, I don't have HI data that's not so public. And so there might be issues, ways to work with this, but what is very obvious is that the sequence data has been coming online, and that the WHO folks and the collaborative centers have been getting pretty good about posting things to GISAID. And so if we look in 2013-2014, we actually got 1,400 sequence HA sequences available. So using these kind of sequence-based, if we rather than HI, if we work with sequences, we can actually do something this year, which would be a very good thing. Martha and Michael had this really excellent work looking at a predictive fitness model for what's going on with clade frequencies. I don't want to belabor this too much because we've heard it at this point, where you can predict how well particular clades will do from their complement of different amino acid substitutions they've had. And you basically have this model where the clade that's doing well has a kind of a stacked up multiple amino acid changes. When they run this forward, they get nice results where opposite what I was showing, where the predicted ratio of how much something will increase falls along with the posterior ratio quite nicely. Importantly, they predict how the trunk branches are going to do, so that just based upon the sequence of these strains, they predict that these ones will take off, and these side branches that you die out will die out. The fitness model is basically looking at, there's a function that's mutational load, and there's a function of how much cross immunity load there is, basically against human immunity. And the fittest strain is something that has as close to basically consensus, as close to a perfect HA as possible, except that the epitopes have changed as much as possible from previous flu seasons. And so when this is fit, it's actually fit with kind of a number of coefficients on top of these. And so the idea is then to kind of tune by doing look-aheads these beta coefficients. And what I'm thinking about now is that the Netflix prize, how that worked was that there were different teams, they each had their own little kind of small facet of things that they had an idea on. And the winning teams were actually just ensembles where everyone got together. They each had their own particular predictor, and then they then there was a kind of global weighting that was done to get betas to each of the predictors, and that's what came out on top for Netflix. So it should be possible to, for example, Richard has this work, and Boris has this work, where of looking at from tree topology of how fit they predict certain strains are, and it also works quite well of predicting which ones will take off just from this kind of branching structure. And so it should be possible to, you know, to have another beta coefficient here. Wouldn't be so hard. So this is what I'm envisioning. There's also improvements that could be made to all of this, which could all be tested. Jesse Bloom has some interesting work where they actually experimentally determine fitnesses of different mutations. And so you could use that as a principled function here. I've been doing some work where I'm trying to figure out from the kind of map and from the sequences to make a predictive model of, if I know the sequence, where will it be on the map? So that could maybe be improved. Geography that Colin talked on last week could be put in, where you get a bonus to strains that are in China, Southeast Asia. Feel nice. So the goal is then always on a server that would do a daily build, pull sequences from GISAID and from IRE, build the model, predict late frequencies, make some pictures, and you could look at it every day, like the forecast, and see what who's doing and where it's going. Okay, that's it.
Brilliant. I guess the last section you talked sort of articulated what I was trying to say earlier. What do you gain? I mean, that last thing you said is brilliant. So why bother about the HI data? I mean, it only matters if there's some massive disconnect between structure and function, or that's a fuzzy way of putting it, you know what I'm getting at. Basically, if suddenly you have to build a completely new involving molecule to deal with a very small shifting place.
I build the normal in people, right? It's not that they sort of match antibody maturation over many years.
But doesn't this connect to the issue of train-strain transcendent immunity? I mean, somehow the memory response of...
The issue is this, that if you look at a particular... if you just do... This is essentially... Correct me if I'm wrong. This is essentially what you were using, where it's, I have just the epitope sites of H3, and I have amino acid distance, so Hamming distance between those sites. And I compare that to my map distance in the model, in the antigenic cartography. And there's a nice straight line here. This is virus, but the R-squared is quite low. So that just the Hamming distance between the epitope regions of two viruses is not highly predictive of the HI distance. If we assume that the HI distance, we don't. It could be the case that the sequence distance is actually a better predictor for vaccine efficacy and so on. But the WHO folks trust this much more than they trust this, and so. Yeah, it would be great to have this kind of slimmed down, and that's where the HI, I think, could come in to get to where you know that if these sequences are this far apart, we could know what the titer is, and we'd know because they really care about titers.
I think it's quite remarkable that you are getting so good results using non-genetic data only, and Michael et al. Are getting so good results using genetic data only. So my question is, what's the problem that the other data is not available if they are already giving the sequence data? So is that it doesn't seem to be a logistical problem if they're already giving the sequences.
I think it is. The logistics are that there's a database and a sequence is a sequence, and it's like just you can put it on the database really easily. Whereas the HI is a bit messier, and it's kind of exists in Excel tables at the moment, and kind of getting a data. You just, if someone were to build the database that could properly ingest that, I think it would start going on the database. But at the moment,
so it is actually a logistical issue.
I think so.
Okay.
I think there might be some.
Just put it.
So I guess another question in the same vein. Now, clearly, direct data on antigenic distance is more to the point than sequence or anything else. So, what's limiting us there? Why don't we have twice as much data? Would it help to have twice as much data? Is there some way of choosing the strains that you may want to get the data on? Would that help?
So right now, I think it's still this way, but it may flip soon, that there will be more strains that have antigenic characterization, at least a few, maybe five or so assays done on them. And then from that pool, the strains are chosen in sequence. But kind of moving forward, we'll probably have they will have more sequencing at the baseline and then choose strains to do the antigenic characterization.
Isn't sequencing cheaper than doing antigenic characterization? I don't know how expensive ferrets are.
Yes.
Sequencing is now cheaper than antigenic characterization, which is very expensive.
Okay.
So it would then, in principle, make sense to say make a guess on the basis of sequence and feed that ranking into ferrets.
The thing is, my suspicion is that if you have there's easily a thousand strains genetically characterized and antigenically characterized each year, that there's not that much diversity, the pi 1% of flu that's circulating. I don't think it's data, at the source it's not data limited to kind of do a good job making these predictions. Logistical issues. Did you have something to say again? I'm sorry, I skipped you.
I have a couple things on my mind. One is, you said something in passing about the credibility intervals reflecting the number of HAI assays done, and I wonder whether you have some thoughts about how to deploy a fixed number of HAI assays more effectively.
You do this much work, but should I do a poorer job on more samples or a better job on fewer samples?
You could probably figure out, so if you picture that map, if you make two HI measurements from very similar sera, they're going to basically tell you the same thing. So if you have a limited number of HI measurements, you want to kind of maximize the spectrum of sera that you want to look at to kind of place.
Oh, but you don't know what's what until you do some of the assays.
Yes.
You don't know who's close and who's far.
You'd have to be able to
bootstrap it.
Yeah.
And kind of relatedly, thinking more about the biology that we got you to draw on the board or whatever, you use Cartesian distance, which maybe says something about what you think, the weights are of the selective weights that are induced by the dimensions of the cartography. And I also sort of wonder whether, since you know where you have a sample of sera, it's actually interesting to think about, how you choose which viruses to raise sera against. But you had a sample of sera, and that seems to suggest something about, or at least could in principle speak to the question of how strong the immune pressure is in different regions on the map. And I don't know whether that's in fact implicit in the predictions that you make, or if, you can sort of imagine the contour circles around each of those points, and then add up or average the weight at each point in the curve.
Oh, I see.
And ask, how strong do I think the pressure is against that?
Yeah, that virus. Would be nice. That would be nice to try to make those contours.
And you need to wait for how many antibodies you have. Right, it's not just the sum, it's an average.
And it would decay over time, but you could have something where you weigh the last year's viruses most. Because human immunity is kind of, you expect to be waning. But
I mean, 68 virus antibodies are still around, and so we're not making anybody, so at least they worked 10 years ago. So,
okay. Yeah.
Anyways,
Yeah, so you weight by frequency, if you have frequency of a virus. Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Thank you.